Well, let me get my glasses on because I can't read anything without them either. So.
Do you have the voice recorder going?
I'll tell you, if I have my glasses off, all I can do is smell things.
I can see.
And it's a poor substitute for reading.
Yes, yes. I can see far away with them, but I got to that point, that late 30s point where.
Oh, gee. You know, I hit the age of 44 in summer of 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And I was teaching organic chemistry that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I suddenly went from being able to read students' problem sets to, oh my God. I had to get a set of bifocals quickly that summer. It was not funny.
Oh, I can imagine.
It was just startling.
Well, I always had really good vision, and then all of a sudden, I went to the eye doctor, and they said, oh, you need readers now.
Well, that's not a disqualifier for of vision quality.
Mm-hmm.
That's age, and you can retain good visual acuity quite readily. I was really surprised. I started learning how to fly a plane when I was 47 years old.
Really?
And the optometrist that I was going to was also a pilot, which I did not know at the time. So he would really take his time working on me. My corrected vision at that time was 20/15. And that surprised me because I've been wearing glasses for 69 years now.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that it's not necessarily how good your visual acuity is, but how you interpret the images that you see.
Of course.
And I found that I could pick out an airport 15 to 20 miles away just by a different textural pattern on the horizon. Yeah. Hmm. A friend of mine usually couldn't see them until we were setting up for our landing approach.
Oh, man. Well, let's go ahead and circle back to the beginning.
Okay.
And if I could just have your name, your approximate date of birth, where you're from, and just some background.
Okay. My name is David C. Taylor, and my expected birth date was July 29th, 1939. I was an early arriver, and I haven't stopped since. And I was born, grew up, and graduated from Bowdoin College in Maine. I had to go out of state for further education as an MA with an MA at Wesleyan University and a PhD at the University of Connecticut. It's also known as UConn, and that creates confusion with people too. My specialty was analytical chemistry, with a minor in organic chemistry.
Okay.
I arrived at Slippery Rock State College with a half-complete dissertation, and in November of 1970, slightly more than 2 years after arrival, I finished.
Yay!
Yes.
And what exactly did you do for us here at Slippery Rock University? Well, I guess it was the state college back then.
Yeah, I was hired in the fall as a temporary assistant professor in the Department of Chemistry. And along the way, I was the director of the Slippery Rock University Planetarium, the rocket room from 1979 through 1987. And I retired from the Department of Chemistry and Physics in 2004. And the merger of physics and chemistry was only a two-year proposition, but it turns out that it's very appropriate because in order to teach chemistry, you have to teach physics.
That is true. I mean, in my particular case, I mean, I did work. I've taken my chemistry classes.
Good.
I have, and at this point, all I remember is how to do the little dot diagrams.
Good. Well, it took me until I was about 40 years old to discover that not everybody dug the chemistry the same way that I did. And I think part of it is a consequence of the fact that practically every innate and learned capability or ability that people have has to be brought to bear when you do study chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my experience studying chemistry has really made anything that I have done over the years extraordinarily easy.
Well, that's true. I mean, because there's the math aspect, there's the spatial aspect.
Yes, it's very much a head game. Mm-hmm. If you have a vivid imagination, that works very, very well in chemistry.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and
I describe that to old radio programs.
Yeah.
You know, where listening to the shadow, the hairs on the back of your neck stood up, mm-hmm. even if you didn't have any at that time.
As I mentioned, you were here during the State College era. Do you have any thoughts or recollections about the transition from State College to university?
No, because chemistry is hardly ever affected by name changes. It's interesting that when I came here in 1968, many local people were still referring to Slippery Rock State College as Slippery Rock State Teachers College. And I even hear today people referring to Slippery Rock University as Slippery Rock State College. It takes a long time to adjust to changes. And the irony is that in chemistry, when changes in theories or changes in, not too many changes in laws, however, but when changes in theory come along, you have to respond quite promptly, quite quickly, to make sure your students are in the are current mm-hmm. with contemporary practice.
Excuse me. And did the department, and you mentioned that the department was chemistry and then became chemistry and physics. How exactly did that change come about?
I think that was a consequence of what was perceived to be a personnel type of challenge that was occurring at the time. And I, at that time, did not really feel too strongly involved in that aspect, because that was about 3 years before I retired or so, and that was not really a big issue.
And I see here that you said that the leadership within the chemistry department did change fairly regularly.
Yeah. According to the collective bargaining agreement, chairs are elected for a 3-year period of time. And it is a challenging task. It takes a lot of time. It's not the world's easiest task when you have a group of people to represent rather than govern.
Mm-hmm.
College professors are notoriously ungovernable.
And which building did you work in?
I spent my entire career in Vincent Science Hall, which I guess is now known as Vincent Science Center, and I missed the move-in of 1968, although I did tour the building while it was under construction when I was here for an interview, and I missed the move-out to advanced technology and science, which I was happy to do, and I had two separate office locations in Vincent Science Hall in 35 years. And after I had a chance to visit the renovated building, I could not find the doorway, which still existed, that actually went into my old office.
It's a very nice building. I mean, this is my first semester here, but it is a very nice building.
It is an incredible building, with the exception of the lack of right-angle corners in many parts of it. That was one of the few things they could not rectify.
Well, it is difficult inside of a round building. Not impossible.
Yeah, it's not impossible, but it is a bit of a challenge. You have to be careful how you place file cabinets so that nothing can fall off the top and be lost forever.
That is true. And what was it like when you came here for your interview? What was your first impression of Slippery Rock College?
Most of the university at that time was located on the top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
I think only World Cultures building was down significantly. We had Maltby Library, Old Main, the auditorium,
mm-hmm.
the original lab school was basically abandoned at the time. We had Morrill Field House, the special education building, the heating plant, and where the present art building is located, that was known as Elgato. That was the student union and food, you know, on-time food service facility, mm-hmm. and the bookstore was in the basement.
Oh, okay.
Weisenflu was the only eating facility on campus at the time, and the interesting thing is that in one of my offices, I could look over the entire eastern section of the campus, which didn't exist in 1968, and then periodically I'd think, well, how much is changing around here? Then I'd go look out the window and enumerate the years in which all of the succeeding buildings were built. And we were looking at a new building here about every 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Either a new building or a major renovation going on somewhere.
Yeah, because I know my experience was the first time I set foot on this campus was in 88.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing on to the east. So basically the campus ended with what's the old union now.
Yeah, yeah, with the Bailey Library and the music building did not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Eisenberg, the library, and the student union building were it.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we have a huge campus, and that has made a wonderful opportunity for new buildings to be designed. I'd like to see the variation in architecture mm-hmm. that now exists on the campus.
Yeah.
But when I first came here in March of 1968, a select group of faculty were organizing a vote of no confidence for the current president, at that time Robert Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly, I still remember the names of many of the people who were involved in that, because most of them at that time were in the Strain Behavioral Science Building, which in 1968 was the science building.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two of them, at least, were colleagues in the physics department, which were on the same floor in Vincent Science Hall as the Department of Chemistry. So no question about the fact that they were committed to quality and students and were themselves dedicated and very human.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the employment situation that I was seeking. The changes that I witnessed were almost invisible to anyone who did not purchase, use, or maintain any electronic equipment. And for a couple of years, we would have to nearly approximate requesting sealed bids for equipment repair. And in my teaching field, chemical instrumentation, if equipment doesn't work, a laboratory experiment often could not be completed.
Mm-hmm.
And about a year later, my purchase request for a replacement transistor powering an ultrasonic cleaner reached the president's office after hanging fire for 3 months. And the purchasing process had started to change.
Mm-hmm.
So that was important.
Mm-hmm.
And this was important to me, as I think I had been hired because I could repair electronic scientific equipment. And I recall that I replaced the power transformer in a, at the time, a $20,000 piece of equipment, mm-hmm. twice. The transformer, I think, at the time was about $500, and you know, an hour and a half of work on my part,
mm-hmm.
saw the new transformer installed. So that helped a lot when we had to deal with usual and regularly recurring budget restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
The second change occurred much greater during 1986-87, when we convinced the General Services Administration that a special type of lamp that cost about $125 had a limited useful operating lifetime. We threw them away when they no longer functioned.
Mm-hmm.
But the auditors would put an inventory number on them, and when they arrived, they physically wanted to view all of the lamps we were supposed to have in our possession. We could not produce them.
Of course not.
We could not produce the item or any of the items, so we showed them our remaining entire supply of lamps, ensuring that they read the expected lifetime on each label. At this point, GSA changed their threshold value on capital equipment to $500 and then began indexing the value according to inflation in the future. GSA had wanted us to account for all items costing more than $100 on a 600-item list. Most of the items had been purchased between 3 to 15 years previously. We didn't, as faculty, have the time or desire to pursue such trivia. The list shrank to about 35 items the following year, and everyone was extremely happy. No, they were gleeful. The first few years of summer school had the first semester courses of both general and organic chemistry running in the pre-session, 3 weeks, minus 1 day for Memorial Day. With 14 days and 2.5 hours of lecture a day and 3.5 hours of laboratory a day, this was a horrendous workload for both the instructor and the students. In the mid-70s, the 3-week pre-session and the 6-week regular session were dropped in favor of 2 5-week sessions. With our entry into the 21st century, the schedule for the equivalent of studying a full year of chemistry was revised to 2 4-week sessions. And this is still a tough schedule for both students and instructor, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But it's cost-effective in terms of transportation, mm-hmm. and it does work very well. Matter of fact, one of the local pharmacists was a student of mine in the summer session, and she, very nice person to know, where I'm in the age group that I'm in now.
Yeah, I have to admit that that's 2 weeks of 6 hours a day of just chemistry. That's tough. Intense.
Yes, it is intense. It's very tough, yeah.
Oh, wow. And what were your, what campus activities were you involved with? Any committees, anything like that?
Early on, I confined most of my committee activities to dealing with the Department of Chemistry matters. I wound up being largely involved in instrument purchase and instrument maintenance. And that did a good job of keeping me very, very busy. And as we acquired more scientific instrumentation each year, the maintenance workload or instrument check for performance capabilities really got busy. But I wound up being secretary for department meetings, and I forget for how many years I did it, but it was a very, very good experience. I was sort of an illegal secretary for the local Sigma Xi chapter because I was not a member of Sigma Xi.
Oh, really?
And I spent a year on the university promotion committee for a year as a temporary replacement. And during that time, I read every application that any faculty member submitted for promotion at that time. And then I would serve on various short-term ad hoc committees.
One of the things that I found when I was researching was with Sigma Xi, the lecture series in the 70s.
Yes.
I found that really interesting, and I have to admit, I don't know if it still goes on.
I don't know either.
I haven't seen anything, but I looked at some of the lecturers you had in, and it was a very impressive list.
It was. I recall one of the speakers was Robert Silverstein, who wrote was co-author of a book called Interpreting Infrared Spectra.
Okay.
And it was a significant textbook work in chemistry, and really very quickly became a classic. And it was a wonderful lecture, too.
I know I was impressed when Mr. Riddleman, who was a local architect, fairly well-known architect in this area, he came in, I think it was 74, and talked about solar energy. I thought that that was far ahead of the time, ahead of the curve.
Before anybody knew what solar energy was. Yeah, very good. Yeah. Yes.
And what were what do you feel were your greatest accomplishments at the school?
Running the planetarium, which became interesting from the standpoint of view that I had had a very long-term interest in photography, and I wound up using my own 35-millimeter film camera at the time, simply because I knew how it behaved. And I look upon the planetarium operation really as applied scientific instrumentation, which, with photography experience, really made it a very easy thing for me to jump into. And people might say, well, what's a chemist doing running a planetarium? And the answer is, well, why not? I had the skill background and interest to pursue that type of work. And then I got involved in the environmental science program back in the late 70s. And I also had an opportunity to teach the course, the University Thinking and Change, and I discovered a lot about myself as a consequence. And one aspect that I really enjoyed was finding chemistry students who were ready to undertake changes of which they did not know they were capable. And being accorded the opportunity to teach basic math, the freshman English courses, research, writing, and composition, reading and composition, research writing, and I also taught aviation meteorology. I think that I undertook the more challenging tasks, and the interesting thing is that some of my colleagues would wonder what reason would I teach aviation meteorology, but at that time I did have an instrument rating for single-engine land aircraft, and before I retired from, you know, teaching, I actually did get a seaplane rating. At the age of 62, and the instrument rating at age 57, which is advanced for earning that type of rating, which people who do fly professionally say is the toughest one there is.
Really?
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit more about this this class, the University Thinking and Change?
Because the University Thinking and Change course was largely the brainchild of Bob McCoskey, and it was predicated upon pretty sound educational knowledge at the time that the process of education creates conflict within people because it insists that they change. And change is something that human beings are very resistant to. And, of course, the process of change you really want to bring out in a person studying in a university environment is you want them to be able to think critically. And a lot of students come from an environment where thinking critically simply does not exist. So the course would explore areas in architecture, art, science, the humanities, history, and use faculty from those areas to sort of serve as special resource people. And I recall one of the prerequisites for being accepted by the faculty who were already teaching the course was to take the Myers-Briggs type inventory test, which proved to be very interesting because the colleague who administered it, when he came to see my results, he suddenly popped up and said, "Oh my," because I landed exactly on the borderline between an extrovert and an introvert. And what struck me about that is that I have no discomfort at all in dealing with public speaking. Mm-hmm. You know, the classroom teaching does that to you. On the other hand, I do very often enjoy, a degree of solitude and private time. And one of my other colleagues, also involved in the program, once responded that he simply goes into the classroom and does his act. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, that is true. Mm-hmm. But it was fascinating from a standpoint of view that I began to understand, one, how I could improve the quality of my communication, because I tend to work quite intuitively, mm-hmm. which means I hear something and a conclusion comes out of me that's perfectly valid, mm-hmm. but nobody understands why. I don't have to understand why, because I figured it out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was really quite a vivid experience for me for at least 3 years, until I think the Department of Academic Support Services decided that this was something that really could be more widely used, mm-hmm. On campus, and they took the program over.
Oh, okay.
So y'all got fired.
Oh. And of course, I mean, I think I might know the answer to this, but I definitely want... I'm kind of curious as to how a chemistry professor ended up teaching writing and composition.
Yeah, that's a good question, because I found when I entered college, writing was a very, very serious challenge for me on a literary basis. Mm-hmm. And throughout my undergraduate experience, I discovered that I had to work very, very hard on putting together written thoughts. And the extra effort was vindicated because I had to write a paper in sociology my sophomore year, and I got an A- on the paper. And that was basically a consequence of the quality and interpretation of the content, but the expression left something else to be desired. Mm-hmm. Senior year, I was taking a course on Roman classics and translation, and the instructor offered people an incentive. You can write a paper, and if you get a grade of B or better on it, you don't have to take the final exam. Well, you've already discovered that I'm open to challenges.
Exactly.
And I did. And I got a B- on the paper. And I was very, very happy, mm-hmm. Because I actually was dealing with a literary area of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And additionally, as I went through graduate school, I had to write a master's thesis. Mm-hmm. I had to take, at that time, a number of examinations which were known as cumulative exams, in which you would learn of the topic a week before the exam.
Oh dear.
It would be independent study on your part, and then you'd sit down and take the exam, not having the slightest idea what would be on the exam. Well, out of 9 exams, we had to pass 6. The first 3, I was not successful on. The next 6, I was completely successful. And when I went from Wesleyan University to the University of Connecticut, my research advisor, who was a proud son of England, insisted that students write papers in each of the courses which he taught. And I think I took 3 courses from him and had a seminar course as well. So I started getting a lot of experience writing papers in the sciences. And when I came to the dissertation, including figures, my dissertation was 290 pages long, which is one of the reasons why it took me 2 years to finish it. I looked on my experience as something that, well, you know, if I had to work extra hard on this type of thing, how can I make students' lives in college easier in the long run for them, but also encourage a little productive suffering along the way? So I would require them to write a paper in each of the advanced courses that I taught, analytical chemistry and chemical instrumentation. Soon the writing across the curriculum requirement came along, and I volunteered to be the department writing across the curriculum person, and I had my students prepare extensive papers that met that requirement. And I haven't heard it, I have not heard of any complaints in the long run.
Well, I honestly think it's a great idea. I mean, right now there's the big push on what they call STEM, which is just the science and the tech and the engineering
yes.
and the math. And I do sometimes wonder if maybe the writing aspect falls along the wayside. So I'm glad that it was brought together.
Well, one thing to keep, one of the great benefits out of the reading and composition and research writing course for me was that I think during the course of the semester, I would have students write about a 500-word paper on a weekly basis. So by the end of the first course, I would have read about 300,000 words. One thing I did discover was that my reading speed markedly increased, and it was already quite up there. But secondly, out of a class of 24 students, I'd find that one student in each of the two classes at that time was a born writer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that really thrilled me because, gee, here's a person who inherently knows how to write effectively,
mm-hmm.
write effectively and well and clearly and so on. About three or four students out of the class really had serious problems writing, which may, and I don't know exactly what the answer is, but may have had a problem reading.
Mm-hmm.
Research writing was a different ball of wax. By that time, some degree of filtration had occurred, and it was mainly getting people brought into the realm of how do you find information.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the internet had not developed to the extent that it did. Sites that were of dubious quality for information had not been fully identified.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, I might say that Wikipedia, at least the technical and scientific areas, is surprisingly good, because only the people who have the knowledge that is appropriate there do contribute to
mm-hmm.
it. And as a matter of fact, I have actually contributed to it as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I just also wanted to ask you, what do you think were your best and worst teaching moments while you were here?
Well, one of the best moments was in 35 years of running chemistry laboratories, I never had an accident occur to any one of my students. And the irony is that when I was an undergraduate, I had two little incidents. And the interesting thing is that because I've worn corrective glasses for a long time, they caught the brunt of the ceremony. And then the second thing is seeing students make discovery about their capabilities and be able to both discover and turn those capabilities from dreams to reality on a regularly recurring basis, that has to be the close second best thing to safety. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst situation was occurred in late 1969 when the president at that time, Albert Wattrell, told the chemistry department to buy the best nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometer that was available.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I had no tenure, and I was not even a full assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
And sinking an elevator was the worst moment. I figured I'd be on the road within the year. Mm-hmm. Well, the magnet for the instrument weighed 4,400 pounds, and the elevator had a placard indicating a capacity of 4,000 pounds, and I figured, that'll work. Mm-hmm. So we loaded the magnet onto the elevator, and on pressing the up button, the elevator sank by 12 feet into the Vincent Science Hall basement. It took a chain fall hoist and an elevator repair technician to raise the elevator the necessary 8 inches to get the magnet into the basement of Vincent Science Hall. And that was really a much better location because of the lack of vibration. Actually, the source of vibration that we had, it took us a total of 10 years to solve.
Really?
Yeah. It's because people would not listen to us. And the problem with the vibration was that a piece of sound-deadening insulation in the housing in one of the ventilating blowers was stuck on the rotor.
Mm.
And the rotor would vibrate, and you could feel the floor of the instrument room going up and down with a changing amplitude with respect to time.
Wow.
Because all the blowers were below mm-hmm. the instrument room. So we turned out to be quite lucky with that particular incident, and I was very surprised, very pleased when I did not yet did not receive an opportunity to go elsewhere.
And we're very glad that you didn't either. We're very glad that you stayed. Let's see, when you first arrived here back in, I think, 68.
Yeah.
Who were the leaders, the presidents, the president, the deans, who was in charge of the union?
Robert Carter was the president who was about to be deposed when I was interviewed in March of 68. Robert Lowry, L-A-R-W-Y, was the interim president until Albert Wattrell was selected. And Al Schmidtlein was the dean for arts and sciences. And I don't recall that we had the name of an academic vice president, if we had one at that time. We didn't have a bargaining agent at that time. The faculty assembly, which was primarily an advisory body, as near as I can tell, was chaired by Murray Shelgren of the Department of Biology. I never met President Carter. He had departed before I had ever arrived. Dr. Schmidtlein, a hard negotiator, was wearing a lot of hats for the School of Arts and Sciences, which had only recently been created. Mm-hmm. And Professor Shelgren was an able, respected leader, carefully pointing out the situation that faculty were going to face as college and faculty expansion was taking place. And of course, in 68, we had about 3,500 students. Enrollment mm-hmm. was predominantly in the area of health, physical education, and so on, mm-hmm. and the sciences were just getting started with the Department of Chemistry being created, I think, in certainly by 1967, possibly in 1966.
Okay, and who were the other people here who influenced you or were significant in your time here?
The influential people at Slippery Rock for me were W.G. Sayre, and that is his legal name now, and Melvin Willis from chemistry. These gentlemen opened me to seeing situations in life much more broadly. And then Monty Holland, Brian Kearney, James Fearday, and Ben Shavitz in physics. To me, the members of the Department of Physics always seemed much more concerned with both the ethics and morality of academic teaching and personnel situations. Robert McCoskey in philosophy, eloquent oratory used most effectively to advance A, which was his holistic view of society, culture, and environment. Mike and Penny Kelly in English. These faculty supported my unexpected candidacy to teach first year English courses during a period when chemistry enrollment was running low. And Henry Lentz in education opened me to the world of international travel and cultural customs. And Mike Wartell, Dean, Natural Sciences and Math, 76 to 1982, he unequivocally supported the development of the planetarium as a rocket room, as a public relations tool to further connecting to the public at large. Glenn Brooken, James Myford, and Bob Crane, Art, introduced me to some of the fundamental principles of art that apply so well to daily life. And I'm sad to say that a surprising number of those gentlemen are no longer living. Mm.
I have to admit, I recognize a lot of these names, and not just Robert McCoskey, who obviously has the center named after him over across the way, but I see a lot of names because I'm a Slippery Rock kid myself.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these names are either names of people I went to school with, mm-hmm. or the last names, I think maybe their wives were my teachers.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting to see, oh, of course the wives were teachers because the husbands were professors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What were the major events or activities that went on while you were here? I'm sure, I mean, you were here for quite a while.
And I still am.
Right. So, I mean, I'm sure you've seen a lot of different things. So maybe just give some examples of those.
Yeah. Well, the student affiliate chapter of the American Chemical Society ran a meeting in miniature in the early 70s that, to me as the faculty advisor, was an unbelievable success both in the content of the work presented by students and the quality of the organizational structure of the meeting itself. I have never seen anything go so smoothly in my life, especially when there was absolutely no prior experience.
Could you maybe describe that? Because when you say meeting in miniature, I just picture little, tiny miniatures of people, and I know that's not what it is.
No. The American Chemical Society has two semi-annual meetings a year, very large meetings in major cities. And for any one particular hour, there may be somewhere between 5 to 10 different talks being given in 20-minute segments.
Okay.
So you're looking at, 15 to 30 different sessions going on at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So a meeting in miniature is a student version of the same thing, except for the perhaps 3 to 8 meetings going on with perhaps for a half hour at a time or so.
Okay.
And then you have to arrange for lunch for people. You have a keynote speaker,
mm-hmm.
and it's the challenge is getting everybody to the right place at the right time, putting a program together so people can make intelligent decisions and not feel that everything they want to hear they have been excluded from.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just an unbelievable experience to watch students handle. And I always took the idea that the student advisor was basically the liaison between the student organization and the university,
mm-hmm.
and the challenge there was to simply arrange for students to be able to talk to the right people to achieve whatever goals they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not take a role deliberately where I ran the operation.
Mm-hmm.
I'd advise, I'd answer questions, I'd make suggestions, but the final decisions were up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh. And during a couple of summers, and this was back in the 80s, we had an on-campus festival that went beyond all expectations for a cultural high. We had ultralight aircraft flying, tethered hot air balloon rides, and concerts by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra as conducted by Morton Gould. And living just off the northeast corner of the campus, as I do, I had a terrifically convenient ringside seat for all the festivities. And I really miss having a continuation of that event. And then we had the three winters of 76, 77, 77, 78, and 78, 79. And these made any winters before or since seem like visits to the tropics. 12-foot-high snowdrifts soared on the west side of Harmony Road and I spent 30 or 45 days in 76, 77 blowing snow out of my driveway. In 78, the drive home became a one-hour nightmare as cars were unable to make the northbound climb on the hill by the Mahala Thompson Stadium. Mm-hmm. Back then, I was driving a front-wheel drive Saab and could climb almost any slope. Nobody else could. Many would start up the hill and then do a reverse random slide downhill. By the time I reversed direction to drive through downtown Slippery Rock, I arrived home after an hour on the road.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, dear.
And as far as national events that occurred during 68 through 2003, I don't really recall any significant campus reaction. And perhaps that's because my office location didn't give me a very good view of the campus if or when any student protests might have occurred. When I arrived in 1968, the lower campus contained only Vincent and the World Cultures Building, later named Spots. From 72 on, about every 3 years, saw a new building project. The University Union, Bailey Library, N. Kerr Thompson Stadium, now Mahala Thompson Stadium, Eisenberg Classroom Building, Boozle Cafeteria, the new art building, completely rebuilt from its previous life as slightly renovated from the previous Union and Bookstore, Swope Music Building, the Art Sculpture Building, the Abersold Recreation Center, Egley Soccer Field, Storm Harbor Equestrian Center, the complete set of new dormitories and apartments in Critchfield Park. And at times, little activity seemed occurring on the campus. However, given an opportunity for thought, the campus was surprisingly busy with construction. Nothing was constant.
And I just wanted to jump back a little bit. We're going to skip, we're not going to skip, but we'll get to the next question. I just wanted to maybe skip back a little bit and talk about your time with the Rocket Room, with the Planetarium. I know you said that you came into it as a out of your love of photography, and
yeah.
I just wanted to, like, how did I really just wanted to know, like, how successful was it within the community at the college and in the community at large?
It's really hard to say in many respects. I was not the first choice as the person to run it. But basically, according to Dean Wartell at the time, he really wanted somebody who was more involved with astronomy. But the astronomy people in the physics department weren't that comfortable with the ancillary tasks involved with the that would be involved with the planetarium. And I wound up getting involved in it because it involved an awful lot of both electronic and electrical work. In other words, we completely wired the planetarium to operate all of the special effects projectors.
Hmm.
And we had to run an immense amount of cabling, build a shelf to hold the equipment, which was the best approach that we could achieve at the time. And the fundamental idea behind the planetarium was to use it as a public relations tool.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Wartell sold this idea very effectively to the administration at the time, and it worked out. We would run two planetarium shows a week, Thursday nights and Saturday nights. During the Christmas season, we would run for planetariums, a very traditional Christmas story, the Star of the East,
mm-hmm.
and we would run daytime programs for grade elementary and high school classes coming in. And the first 6.5 or so years went very well with getting our word out to people. One member of the public relations office at that time was very good at taking copy that I submitted and getting it out into newspapers around the area. Mm-hmm. And then that person departed, and then it suddenly started going downhill. Mm-hmm. I never saw so many errors occur in public information published regarding the planetarium in my life. And that's really what brought it to an end, because we became totally undependable, unpredictable for people. So that was, so while things, while information entered the public realm effectively, well, and reliably, we developed quite a following. But when stuff became challenging, that was moving toward the end. I simply could not handle that type of situation.
Understandable. And it's a shame, because I mean I thought it was, I mean, I found it to be a very, very interesting program. I thought found it to be, you know, a, again, a very good PR move with with the community at large.
Yeah.
That's very, actually really upsetting. Is there, I mean, are there other memorable events or maybe other things that really stand out to you during your time here?
Given enough time, I could probably enumerate almost every one of them, but I'm not going to.
What, if anything, do you miss about working and being a professor here?
Well, I miss students. I miss interacting with colleagues. I don't miss the administrative or collective bargaining unit required tasks. And only the development of the word processor made the repetitive 5-year task of preparing a self-evaluation tolerable. And it's simply because, you know, you could edit and add very, very easily.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the major problem, the collective bargaining unit, knowing how things were done prior to the presence of the faculty, APSCUF. I could see potential problems arising of a significant nature if we had not had APSCUF.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I realized that's actually encouraged the faculty and administration to work somewhat more closely together, too.
Mm-hmm. And just to wrap up, what words of wisdom do you have for the Slippery Rock community, or how would you like to be remembered?
Well, be human. Every and each student deserves a reasonable hearing. So do colleagues. Try to learn continuously. Whatever new that you learn does not necessarily have to have a strong, direct connection to academia. New knowledge changes your mental flexibility and enhances overall perspectives on everything.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for coming in.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.